Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So today we are looking at what I think is a masterclass in failure. And I don't mean that in a bad way at all. I mean it in the truest scientific sense, you know, where a failure tells you exactly where the boundaries of reality are.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's often more valuable than a success. If everything works perfectly the first time, you probably haven't learned anything new.
Right.
If it breaks, that's when you learn physics.
Exactly. And the target of this research was, well, it was one of the oldest contradictions in material science. It's that trade-off every engineer just hates, the battle between strength and stretchiness in steel.
Right. This is really the holy grail of metallurgy. In the automotive industry, I mean, this contradiction is everything. Think about the car you drive. You want the passenger cell, the cage you sit in, to be incredibly rigid to protect you. But you also want the crumple zones to absorb energy during a crash.
Well, that means they need to deform. They have to deform without just snapping.
Correct. But here's the problem. Usually, if you make steel super strong, it gets brittle.
Right.
If you make it ductile, you know, stretchy, it becomes weak. You can rarely have both at the extreme levels we really want.
Except, of course, for this one specific material called T2BIP steel, twinning-induced plasticity.
Yes. 2BIP is the exception. It has incredibly high strength and high ductility. It sort of breaks the rules.
Okay, so before we get into why we aren't all driving around in 2WIP cars right now, let's unpack the mechanism a bit. Most metals deform by atoms just slipping past each other, right?
That's the standard way, yeah. Think of it like a deck of cards sliding across a table.
Okay.
That's slip. And eventually they slide too far, they separate, and the metal fractures. 2WIP steel is different. It relies on a specific crystal structure called austenite.
Austenite. Right, but that's usually only stable at really high temperatures, like when the steel is glowing red hot.
Usually, yes. But in 20P steel, the chemistry is tweaked so that the steel stays fully austenitic even at room temperature. It's a face-centered cubic structure. When you stress this material, so you crash the car, instead of the atoms just slipping, the crystal structure actually flips. It creates twins.
Twins. Like mirrors.
Atomic mirrors, exactly.
Yeah.
The lattice reorients itself to form a mirror image across a boundary. And these twin boundaries, they act like tiny walls inside the metal. They stop the defects, the dislocations from moving.
So the more you crash it or pull it, the more of these barriers it creates.
Precisely. It hardens as it deforms. It actually gets stronger the more you try to break it.
Okay, so we have a miracle metal. It's strong, it stretches, it hardens itself. Why is this a metallurgical mystery? And not just the industry standard. Why isn't every car made of this?
Two reasons. Manganese and money.
Always money.
To get that 2WIP effect, you need the steel to stay austenitic at room temperature. Iron, you know, naturally wants to turn into ferrite, a different crystal structure, when it cools. To force it to stay as austenite, you have to add a massive amount of manganese.
How much is massive?
We're talking 20 to 30% by weight.
Wow.
Yeah.
That seems huge. Most alloys are, what, a fraction of a percent?
Exactly. 30% is enormous. And manganese is expensive. But honestly, the cost isn't even the biggest headache for manufacturers. Processing high manganese steel is an absolute nightmare.
A nightmare? How?
Well, for one, manganese has a very high vapor pressure. So when you're melting the steel in the furnace, the manganese is literally trying to evaporate out of the pot.
So you lose it before you even start.
You lose a lot of it, yeah.
Yeah.
And it attacks the lining of the furnace, just fights you every step of the way.
Wow.
It does. And then when you try to cast it into strips, which is the modern, you know, efficient way to make steel sheets for cars, you get these specific defects. The industry calls them dent defects.
Dents? Like someone actually hit it with a hammer.
Essentially, yeah. Because the heat transfer is so uneven thanks to the manganese, the surface quality is just terrible. It has poor machinability, and sometimes it suffers from something called delayed fracture, where it breaks long after you've formed it.
So it's this amazing material that is almost impossible to make economically or reliably.
Exactly. Which brings us to the mission of today's deep dive. This thesis we're looking at, it asked a really bold question. Can we get that 2WIP effect, that magical strengthening, without the 30% manganese price tag?
They wanted 20P-assisted steel.
Right. The goal was to drop the overall manganese content from that 20-30% range all the way down to under 8%.
That's a huge reduction. But if you take away the main ingredient that stabilizes the austenite, how do you keep the properties? This, I guess, brings us to what I'm calling the Trojan horse strategy.
That's a good way to put it. Or maybe the chocolate chip cookie strategy.
Okay, let's stick with the cookie. It's definitely more approachable.
Okay, so in standard 2IP steel, the whole cookie is made of chocolate. The entire matrix is that high manganese austenite. The hypothesis here was that you don't need the whole steel to be high manganese.
Hmm.
You just need islands of it.
So a plain dolo manganese ferrite with these high manganese chocolate chips sprinkled throughout.
Precisely. The idea is that the plain dough, the ferrite, makes up the bulk of the volume and keeps the cost down. But embedded inside are these islands of austenite.
Yeah.
And if you can concentrate the manganese just in those islands, get it up to over 25% locally, they should still trigger that twinning mechanism when the steel is stressed.
You get the benefit of the expensive alloy, but you're only paying for it in the chips, not the whole cookie.
Exactly.
But okay, here's the problem I see right away. You can't just stir chips into molten steel. Once it melts, it mixes, the liquid solution. How do you force the manganese to unmix and clump up into these little islands?
You have to use thermodynamics. You have to design a heat treatment cycle that basically tricks the atoms into moving where you want them.
Hmm.
And the researcher, Kang, designed this really complex three-step process to do it.
Okay, let's walk through this recipe because this is where the design part of material science really shines. So step one is the reset.
Step one, you heat the alloy to 750 degrees Celsius. This turns everything into austenite. Then you quench it, cool it instantly to room temperature. This turns the microstructure into martensite.
And martensite is the hardest, most brittle form of steel. Why would you start there if you want ductility?
Because it's uniform. You have to wipe the slate clean. If you start with a messy structure, your diffusion later on is just going to be unpredictable. Martensite gives you a homogeneous blank canvas to work with.
Okay, slate wiped. Step two. This one seems like the critical part, the trap.
This is where the magic is supposed to happen. You heat the steel back up to 550 Celsius and you just hold it there. This is tempering. When you temper martensite, it decomposes into two things, ferrite and cementite.
Cementite, iron carbide, those hard little particles.
Yes. Now here is the thermodynamic trick. Manganese loves cementite. It is thermodynamically more stable inside the cementite crystal structure than it is in the ferrite. So if you provide enough heat for the atoms to move, the manganese will migrate. It will diffuse out of the ferrite and pack itself into these tiny cementite particles.
You're using the cementite almost like a little storage battery for manganese.
That's a perfect analogy.
Mm-hmm.
But diffusion in solids is slow. I mean, atoms have to wiggle past each other. So Kang held the steel at 550 degrees for up to 800 hours.
800 hours? That's over a month in the oven.
It is a very long time. But the prediction was worth it. By the end of this step, the calculation showed those cementite particles would contain somewhere between 35 and 47% manganese.
So we have our concentrated islands. The chips are now super rich in manganese, but they're currently cementite, which is brittle and, you know, useless for TWIP. We need them to be austenite.
And that's step three, the transformation. You hit the steel with a quick blast of heat intercritical annealing around 600 to 700 degrees Celsius for just 5 minutes.
Why only 5 minutes? After waiting a whole month, why the big rush?
Because you're fighting the clock. You want the heat to transform the Mn-rich cementite into Mn-rich austenite. But if you hold it too long, equilibrium kicks in. The manganese will look at the surrounding ferrite, see that the concentration is low, and start to diffuse back out.
It leaks.
It leaks.
Ugh.
So you have to flash convert the particle and then freeze it before that manganese can escape.
That is such a high-stakes process. Create the trap, fill it with manganese over a month, and then quickly flip a switch to turn it into austenite without letting it spill. And they didn't just guess this would work. They modeled it first.
Oh, yeah. They use MT Data, which is this powerful thermodynamic calculation software. It's the industry standard for this kind of work. They modeled three different alloys. Alloy 1 had 5% manganese, alloys 2 and 3 bumped at the carbon, and then alloy 3 went all the way up to 7% manganese.
But all of them are still way below the 20% standard for traditional TWIP.
Correct. And the computer basically gave them the green light. It predicted that at 550 Celsius, the cementite would reach those super high manganese concentrations. On paper, this is a slam dunk.
I love the phrase on paper in science. Mm-hmm. It almost always precedes a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to part three, the reality check. So they run the 800-hour cycle. They do the flash anneal. They put the steel under the microscope. What did they actually see?
Well, the first warning sign was something called banding. Imagine wood grain. Mm. The steel had these streaks of light and dark running along the direction it was rolled.
What causes that?
Manganese segregation. Even during the initial melting at 1200 degrees, before they even started the heat treatment, the manganese just didn't mix perfectly. It's a heavy, kind of sluggish atom. So you had regions that started with more manganese and regions with less.
So the dough wasn't mixed well to begin with. That has to throw off the calculations.
It definitely complicates them. But that wasn't the fatal flaw. The fatal flaw was something they called the dilution problem. And this just highlights the massive difference between thermodynamic theory and kinetic reality.
Okay, let's break this down because this feels like the real turning point of the thesis.
So remember step three, that flash heating?
Yeah.
They expected the new austenite to nucleate, to start growing on the cementite particles.
Right, like a snake eating an egg. It consumes the cementite and just takes its place.
That was the hope. If it did that, it would inherit all that 40% manganese concentration.
Hmm.
But what actually happened was that the austenite nucleated at the interface, at the border between the cementite and the ferrite.
Okay. Why does that matter so much?
Because from the border, it grew in both directions. It ate the Mn-rich cementite, yes.
Yeah.
But it also grew outward into the surrounding ferrite.
And the ferrite is the plain dough. It has almost no manganese in it.
Exactly. So imagine you have a shot glass of concentrated espresso. That's your cementite.
Mm-hmm.
You pour it into a bucket of water. That's the ferrite it consumed. You don't have espresso anymore.
Yeah.
You just have slightly dirty water.
The austenite diluted itself immediately upon birth.
Instantly. The growth into the ferrite happened at the same time as the consumption of the cementite.
Mm-hmm.
So the manganese concentration in the final austenite islands was way, way lower than the 30-40% they needed.
So the seed was rich, but the fruit was watery.
And because the manganese concentration was diluted, the austenite just wasn't stable enough.
Yeah.
It couldn't trigger the 2W effect properly. It was just there.
Now, in the middle of all this, there was a really interesting sidebar in the thesis about how hard it was to even measure this failure. They needed to know the carbon content of these tiny islands to confirm their theories, but they couldn't use a standard electron microscope.
Yeah, this is a classic lab headache that usually gets cut from the final papers, but it's crucial here.
Mm-hmm.
Usually you use something called EDS, energy dispersive spectroscopy, to check for elements. You shoot electrons at the sample, and it shoots X-rays back that tell you this is iron, this is manganese.
But you can't check for carbon with EDS.
You can, but it's wildly inaccurate. Carbon is everywhere. Specifically, the vacuum chambers in these microscopes use oil pumps.
Oil pumps?
Yes, to create the vacuum. But there are always tiny amounts of oil vapor hydrocarbons floating around in the chamber. When the high-energy electron beam hits your sample, it cracks those hydrocarbon molecules.
And it leaves carbon behind.
Right. It deposits a layer of carbon right on your sample while you're scanning it.
Yeah.
So the machine thinks the sample is full of carbon, but it's actually just dirty from the microscope itself.
So it's like trying to measure how wet a sponge is while you're standing out in the rain.
That's a perfect analogy. So Kang and the team had to get creative. They used X-ray diffraction, or XRD. They measured the lattice parameter, the actual physical spacing between the iron atoms.
How does that help?
Well, carbon atoms are small. They sit in the gaps between the iron atoms, and they push them apart.
Ah, okay.
The more carbon you have, the bigger the gap. So they measured the expansion of the crystal lattice and worked backward mathematically to calculate the carbon content.
That is incredibly clever. It shows that even when the main experiment is failing, the rigorous science is still happening.
Absolutely. You have to verify why it failed.
So the microstructure isn't what they designed. The austenite is diluted. But the ultimate test is always mechanical. Did they actually pull the steel? Did it perform?
They performed tensile tests. And the results were disappointing. The strength and elongation were just nowhere near the targets.
But here's the twist. The failure wasn't just because of the dilution problem we just talked about.
Yeah.
There was another problem, one that had nothing to do with chemistry and everything to do with scale.
The scale-up problem. This is a trap that catches so many researchers when they move from theory to practice.
Explain the setup.
So when they did the microscopy studies, you know, checking the crystals, measuring the banding, they used a machine called a dilatometer. This machine uses these tiny little cylinders of steel, maybe 5 millimeters across.
Tiny.
Very tiny. And a dilatometer uses induction or gas to heat those little cylinders almost instantly. It can hit 700 degrees Celsius in seconds and hold it perfectly.
So that flash heat step worked perfectly on the small samples.
Right. But for a tensile test, where you actually pull the steel apart until it breaks, you need a much bigger sample. A dog bone bar. It's thick, it's long, about 130 millimeters. You just need that size for the grips of the machine.
Okay, so how did they heat the big bars?
To heat those up for that final step, they use a salt bath.
Which is exactly what it sounds like, a bath of molten salt.
Yes. It's standard industrial practice for heat treatment. You have a pot of liquid salt at 700 degrees. You drop the steel in. But think about the physics of that. You drop a big, cold bar of steel into hot liquid.
It doesn't heat up instantly.
Not at all. There's a thermal lag. The center of that bar takes time to get hot.
And we just said that step three relies on speed. You only have 5 minutes before the manganese starts leaking out.
Exactly. So the slow heating rate in the salt bath meant the steel spent way too much time in the danger zone. The microstructure evolved differently in the big bar than it did in the tiny cylinders. The slow heating likely allowed even more diffusion and other transformations that they just didn't account for.
So they essentially tested a different material.
A different material than the one they had analyzed so carefully under the microscope, yes.
That is just so frustrating. It's like perfecting a cake recipe in a tiny easy bake oven and then wondering why it burns when you try to make a massive wedding cake in a professional convection oven. The heat transfer is totally different.
Thermal mass is a variable you cannot ignore. The thesis concluded that the heating rate in the salt bath was just insufficient to achieve the target structure.
So, where does this leave us? The thesis is titled, The Quest for Twilight-Persisted Steel? Did the quest just fail?
In terms of producing a commercial product today, yes, it didn't work. The manganese dilution was too severe, and the processing window was just way too tight to be practical.
That feels like a heavy defeat after all that work.
But scientifically, I think it's a success because it mapped the terrain. We now know that the Trojan horse method concentrating manganese in cementite, it works thermodynamically. The battery charges up perfectly. The problem is the discharge.
The kinetics, the movement of the growing crystal.
Right. The austenite is just too hungry for the ferrite. And this finding tells an ex-researcher, hey, the battery works. But if you want to use this stored manganese, you need to find a way to stop the austenite from growing backward into the matrix.
So how would you even fix that? Maybe alloy the ferrite with something else to make it less tasty to the austenite?
That's one path, for sure. You could add silicon or aluminum to suppress the cementite dissolution speed. Or you solve the heating problem. You use industrial induction heating to make the temperature jump instantaneous for the whole coil and try to outrun the diffusion speed.
It seems like we're constantly trying to micromanage atoms, and they're constantly finding ways to disobey us.
Well, they follow the laws of physics, not our engineering desires.
Yeah.
The computer simulations, the MT data, they were perfect for equilibrium. They told us where the atoms wanted to end up eventually if you gave them infinite time and ideal conditions.
But the computer didn't account for the chaotic race to actually get there.
And it didn't account for the fact that a big bar of steel heats up slower than a small one. It's a huge reminder that metallurgy is not just chemistry. It's geometry. It's heat transfer. And it's time.
So for the listener driving their car today, thinking about the steel that's protecting them,
just know that making that steel lighter and stronger isn't just about mixing ingredients in a pot. It involves manipulating crystal structures at the atomic level, fighting against thermodynamics, and sometimes spending 800 hours waiting for atoms to diffuse, only to have them scatter in the wrong direction in 5 minutes.
It really highlights the gap between designing a material on a computer and then actually holding it in your hand. We talk so much now about AI discovery and computational materials science.
We do.
Yeah.
And they're incredibly powerful tools. But nature bats last. Always.
That is a humbling thought to end on. If we can't control the growth direction of a single microscopic grain of austenite, how much control do we really have? It makes you wonder if we're discovering materials or just negotiating with them. Thanks for listening to this deep dive into the messy reality of materials science.
See you next time.